Hey, it's Bob Pickett. We're on our way to the legendary Broken Spoke. Come on, let's get out of the truck and head inside. Let's go inside. Get ready for another Tale from the Broken Spoke.
Have we got some stories for you today. Bob Pickett, Monty Warden, and our good buddy LT. We're right here at B2 at the Broken Spoke, and it's time for another great podcast, Tales from the Broken Spoke. Larry, I call you LT because I've known you for years because of Sammy Allred and the Geese Lost. Your actual name is?
Larry Telford.
Okay, yeah. Okay. But he's been LT to me for...
I was only,
since last century.
You only introduced to me as LT back in probably 90, maybe, when we met. You know, Sammy Allred.
Something like that, Monty.
Introduced us. Seemed like we were, I think we might have met at the old backyard at some Willie thing.
Probably 4th of July picnic, maybe, something like that.
I think it might have been like a South By. Did Willie used to do South By? I think he would do March dates out there. And I know the Geezenslaws were on a Willie date there, and Sammy made sure that I met LT.
Well, Tim O'Connor had that out there, and, of course, Tim O'Connor and Willie were
they were tight.
So tight for all those years, and I did a bunch of stuff with Tim. I had a company called Austin Keyboard Rental, so I had the back line for Aquafest and the backyard and a bunch of different venues here in town, then, of course, I got here in 76, which, you know.
Where'd you come here from,
76?
Huh?
Yeah.
I
come
from
Denton. Prime time.
I come from Denton.
Okay.
Right up north of Dallas. And my hometown's Collinsville, Texas, which is a little farming community up there. But my wife and I decided to borrow $500 and get in the van, drive down to Austin, and set up shop.
Was it because of the music industry?
It was. Yeah, it was strictly for the music. My first week here, I got a job with a traveling circus. giving out free tickets to the traveling circus. My wife and I were living on $1 a day at that time. I mean, we were broke.
What happened? Why'd you leave the traveling circus?
Was that at the Expo Center? Where would it have been?
No, it was one of these little mom-and-pop circuses that set up at, like, down here at, you know, any parking lot would fit, you know, it would fit at. But the third week, I got an offer to go to Brownsville, Texas for 2 weeks playing keyboards with this car dealer. They had a band on the side.
That's so awesome. And at 76, what would have been your rig? Like just a Rhodes?
Oh, I had a Hammond B3 and a Fender Rhodes. And
how did you tote it?
I had an Econoline van
and had
everything in there and drove down to Brownsville. And
so you showed up in Austin with a van. So you knew you were going to get some gigs.
Yeah, you know, because if you had a PA or a van, you were
that's
in.
Right. That's right.
And so this guy offered me $1,000 a week to go down to Brownsville in 1970.
That's great money back then.
Well, $1,000 a week's like, you know,
it's good money now,
$1,000.
Bob.
Yeah.
Say goodbye to the circus. I'd go for that gig. Yeah.
So, but what I didn't know about the gig was he expected you to play the gig and then at night go over to the room and play poker. And he would win the money back from him.
Wow,
that was his,
so
and that's
great.
What he did with it, with all the guys. But at the time, I wasn't a poker player, and I wasn't going. He says, "Oh, I'll teach you." And I said, "I don't think so."
That's an expensive college, right there.
Yeah,
right.
You know. So I came back with all of my money, and I still got half of that money today. You know, I mean, I held on to it, and thankfully. My wife has always done great, you know. She was a hairdresser and had a shop here in Austin, still does. And, you know.
Where was her shop back then, back in the 70s?
She worked for another lady here in town. And actually, instead of doing hair, she decided to do sculptured nails, which was great.
Yeah.
And every musician needs a hairdresser, I'll tell you that. You know,
I know George Jones had one that lived at the estate with him.
Well, yeah, they'll keep you, you know, they'll keep you in the music business.
Right.
That's for sure.
Oh, boy. And I'm learning a lot of things today, I can tell you.
It's been a great journey. You know, I was just thinking about it, you know, the music journey. But I met Willie back in 1973.
Before you moved down here?
In Atoka, Oklahoma. Yeah, I did a show up there in Atoka. Every time Willie and I talk about it, he calls it Old Dusty Atoka because they took a bulldozer and raked back all the grass off the land and just let everybody out there. And then a dust storm came up, and it was horrible. Red dust, Oklahoma dust.
Yeah.
And there's video of that show somewhere. And we're all out on stage on the last song, doing Goodnight Irene or something like that. And then when I got down to Austin in 76, I did that first show going to Brownsville. And then I hooked up with a band called the Desperados back during those days. And then later on, I met Kinky Friedman. And we started doing some shows with Kinky. And this was long before Sammy ever...
Yeah, Sammy already came
into the picture.
Now, where would you pick with Kinky? Just around town? Or would you
Liberty Lunch. Liberty Lunch. I think we did shows at Fitzgerald's.
In Houston.
Yeah, and the one that used to be the old bank building, Rockefeller's. Yeah.
You know, that Bonnie and Clyde hit that bank.
No kidding.
Yeah. Is that so cool?
Oh, man, that's great.
It's a club in Houston called Rockefeller's.
I remember that, yeah.
And the backstage, the dressing room, was the old vault. And sure enough, that was one of the places that Bonnie and Clyde hit. And I think it was like the biggest bank in Houston they hit, but they only got away with $37 because the teller told them the safe was on a timer. And because it was such a big bank, they believed it, and there was no timer.
I'll be dang.
So you remember the Texas Jew Boys for a while with Kinky, or official member, or
no,
what? Just played an incident?
At the time, he really didn't call us the Jew Boys. The Jew Boys was an earlier band, you know, the band that he had.
Mm-hmm.
And then for a while, you know, it's just any band that he had was the Jew Boys. But Kinkster's a fine American, let me tell you.
We've been trying to get Kinky on this show for a while.
Oh, you got to get Kinky. Kinky, if you're listening, come on.
Come
down.
On in, man. Always welcome,
man.
Kinky.
Great man, great songwriter, just great bon vivant, you know.
Sold American.
Yeah.
You know.
Amen.
Yeah, just all those songs that Kinky put together.
Well, I mean, you know, they don't make Jews like Jesus anymore. That's one of the best songs he's ever written.
You know, the first time that I saw Kinky Friedman, true story, I was in high school, graduating, 1979. My grandmother from California came down for my high school graduation. We had just gotten cable at the house. So I turned to the PBS station, and it's something like Austin Seelen. It could have been, but there's Kinky on TV. My grandmother, 50-something-year-old grandmother, is watching it, and Kinky is on TV singing, "I'm proud to be an asshole from El Paso." And she goes, my grandmother's from California. She goes, "I don't know what, we don't have shows like that in California. I can't believe you have that in Texas." Years later, I met Kinky. He signed a book for us, said, "Hey, I'm the asshole that sang that song for you."
That's right. First time I met him, I was fixing to go do something over at the old Austin City Limits thing on UT campus.
Yeah.
On the Rust building. And he came out of some office there, and I was just standing around waiting to be interviewed in the old studio there. And he was like, he had his guitar, and he had a briefcase, and he had a cigar.
Unlit cigar, yeah.
Yeah, unlit cigar, right. And so he goes, "Hey, man, you pick, right?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he goes, "Here, hold this." So he had me hold his guitar case, and he's like fumbling around for keys. And he said, "Hold my briefcase." So I have his guitar and briefcase, and he goes, "Hang on a second." And he pulled out his wallet, and he goes, "Hold this for me." And then he just went into the room. And I was just standing there.
With his wallet?
With his wallet, his guitar, and his briefcase. And I was standing there, and I just went, "What the hell is going on?" I'd never met him. I was like, you know, I was like 18, 19 years old.
That's trust, brother.
Popped his head up, and he goes, "I just want to see how long you were going to stand there."
It was a test?
Oh,
he's
yeah.
just being a prick, you know?
Yeah.
A good dude.
Yeah.
But it's so funny. It started off, "You pick, don't you?" So, like, I was qualified to hold a guitar case, which is just ridiculous, you know?
Yeah. I'm sure you got some crazy Kinky stories, too, don't you?
Yeah.
What's the craziest thing happened to you?
Well,
Nothing you can say on this show.
Well, that's exactly what
he's trying to think of the clean version. I know.
I was trying to think version. How I was going to do a fast edit here.
Okay, we're going to
on a show in Dallas.
Uncensored Tales of the Broken Spoke, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, Kiki had some song titles like Waitress, Please Waitress.
Oh, I know that one, yeah. And, there's some stuff we can't say.
A waitress took him to task on it in Dallas one night.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And but Kiki would test you, you know, in the shows. One of the funniest things that ever happened, Kiki was with Bob and Sam, and they'd come in to play, and of course, Sweet Mary was on fiddle, and Sammy was on mandolin, and Kinky was on acoustic guitar. And Kinky, when you were doing a song with Kinky, sometimes he'd go, pick it up, talking about the speed of the song, you know. And he did that on the air with Sam and Bob and in the middle of the song, and Sammy says, well, you're the only one playing rhythm here. Put it back on him, you know. I tell you, the first time I think that I remember seeing Sammy and Kinky together was at Liberty Lunch. I was playing with Kinky and Sammy and Jake and Wichita and Kevin. They all came in, and Dale and did the show with us, and I think that was the first time that I ever seen the group of guys that I would go on to spend years with.
Right. The Giesenslaw brothers.
Yeah. Yeah. As the Giesenslaw.
Yeah. And the way, and before then, I was with Leroy Parnell. Leroy called me out of the blue and said, you want to play keys with me? And I said, I sure do. But I had one stipulation.
What was that?
I said, Leroy, when we're on the road, I have to eat good food, because at the time, junk food, you know, and Jack in the Box and that stuff, it tore me up, you know. It was one of those things. And he says, well, I like chicken fried steak and stuff. I said, I'm in, you know.
We had, for years, the Wagoneers, we would eat three meals a day at Taco Bell. I love Taco Bell. And it's just, and I was a kid, you know.
Yeah.
So we had this guy come on board with us, and he was a little bit older, you know, and after about a week, maybe a week and a half, he goes, can we not eat at Taco Bell today? just today.
Just once. Yeah.
And I just went, no. But it was so funny, because you don't even think, because when you're a kid, your body's a machine, and then you get a little older and go, yeah, I got to eat good food, you know,
I tell you, playing with Leroy was just, it was wonderful, because he's such a good guy. He's a sweetheart of a guy.
What years were this with Leroy? Because I'm getting ready to throw you something.
Early 80s.
Okay.
You know, something like that. And
but that was touring. That wasn't here. You guys didn't play Chelsea Street Club.
Oh, yes, we did. We played
Chelsea. Okay, I need to apologize. I was a young college kid that was obnoxious. That after three or four funeral drinks, those kinds of that would yell for more Haggard songs. That was me, and I want to apologize. I've apologized to Leroy many times.
Well, I tell you,
could do a whole tour of Chelsea Street Pub.
Oh, we were. Oh, we'd always hit the one down at Barton Creek Mall when it opened.
You,
you know,
were at the same place a week. Then you'd go to like five or six towns.
They're all over, all over the state.
Yeah, that was a great way to learn how to play all night. You know.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. And when I got in the band, Terry McBride was the bass player.
Sure. That's when I met Terry.
And Rick Connell was the drummer for the band. And Rick had moved from Nashville, and he'd played a lot of those Ronnie Millsap sessions and things like that.
Hmm.
And back then, Leroy would let Terry sing maybe two songs a night. Because Terry could take over the show. There's no doubt about that.
Sure. Terry's amazing.
Yeah. It just, fantastic.
It still is, and just... There's all of them sweetheart of guys. They were just great people.
That'd be a heck of a band.
It was,
And then they're playing Chelsea Street Pub.
And
that's
what I mean.
It's
like the quality. Like, you don't, just because you might be in some little joint, you know, you don't know the people that you're seeing. I mean, it's like you just figure just that you look at the chops. You got LT and Leroy and Terry. How many gigs those are, how many millions of records sold, how many hit records played on, and yet you just think you're seeing some band at Chelsea Street Pub, and that's the whole thing about Texas is there are just so many great pickers here, and Texans tend to have that work ethic of just you just get up and go to work, and you take the job, man.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Well, what I remember, they were great shows.
Yeah.
And that was one thing that made Austin special.
Right.
Was the music was just, and it still is, the music was just so special. As a college kid, you can go out, spend $5, $10, and you're going to have a heck of a night just listening to all the music around here. You were with Leroy. That's cool.
Yeah, 2 years. And one of the shows I remember was when we went to Gilly's in Pasadena and played a contest. And we were on fire. We came out blazing. And Leroy was playing that gold top. And, you know, the beautiful thing about Leroy's music is it's roadhouse music, but also it's country, it's blues. He drags out that slide and look out. All of a sudden, now you're in the middle of Southern rock. And we just had a great show. And we would have won the contest. But one of the bands had brought three busloads of fans in there to back them up, you know, and went over the crowd and stuff. And we didn't do that. We was in a Dodge van. And
I only played one, like, Battle of the Bands type contest in my life. And it was in Houston, as a matter of fact. It wasn't in Pasadena, but it was in Houston. And I don't know how we got entered into it, but it was almost like the fix was in. This has been like 82, so I'm, how old am I? I'm 15, you know, and we're a hot little rockabilly band. And we had them going nuts, and they going, now let's welcome, you know, Joe Schmo and the Joes, you know, whoever it was. And this band came out, just a little four-piece band, and they were playing Skinner stuff, which they were good, but I mean, it was Skinner, you know. So we knew we had that beat. And then, like, their last song, these chicks got on stage and took their shirts off, and it had the band's name. And I've never been in a band good enough to compete with that.
You're not going to try that out here at the Spoke, man, are you?
It's just like, well, there you go. You know, that's the whole thing. Show business took the, you know, first prize over a, you know, talent. I
you
guess.
Know what they say about kids and dogs and
what's
good looking women, you know, is you don't want to follow them.
You don't want to follow them. No, that's fantastic. I just went, wow, that is awesome.
Golly. But, so, yeah.
Anyway, so I guess what LT and I are trying to tell you is don't enter talent contests in Harris County.
No.
You ain't going to win.
Stay out of that county, huh?
It can be tough on you, you know. But those years was great. You know, we played a lot of shows in Colorado also with Leroy. And, you know, ski lodges and places like that up there. We did some trips there. And
and this was years before he was signed to Aerosmith.
That's where he got the record. Yeah.
And he was starting to write really great songs. Right. Some of the early demos that I've got that he did off of cassettes. I still got cassettes on Leroy and Terry. And you could see the writing on the wall coming in of where it was going and how it was going to be. And I tell you, when those guys went to Nashville, it was monumental.
Sure.
Because you knew that something was going to happen. Right. And they weren't going to leave, you know, without getting signed and
making their mark.
Absolutely. Yeah, they did make their mark. And Terry still, it's good to see Terry back on the road performing now.
They're both just, you know, and Leroy's doing great, and they're both just still writing great songs.
Yeah.
So you started, when did you meet Sam, and then how long from you meeting him did you become a Giesen Slaw, you reckon?
Here's the way the story went.
But what is the truth?
Is this a true story? That's
you'll hear three versions.
That's right. That's what I mean. Yeah.
None of them are true.
Okay.
Except this one.
Okay, so you're going to tell us the truth now.
Yeah.
And he's got his hand up when he's telling. It's like he's in a court of law, so I know he's telling the truth.
Neighbors, my hand is on my heart.
Yes.
Where's my heart?
No. You have a heart, okay.
One of my very first friends that I met in Austin in 1976 was my friend Mark Millett. And Mark was on the road with the Fabulous Thunderbirds and as a road manager, and also he worked with Sleep at the Wheel later on. And Mark came over to my house one day and he said, hey, there's this band called the Giesenslaws, and in a few weeks they're going to be on Austin City Limits. You ought to go play keyboards for the Giesenslaws. And I said, dadgum, that sounds good. I want to be on Austin City Limits. And just so happened that a week later, there was this guy named Ken Idaho who was with the Jimmy Heap band.
Wow, and I hadn't heard that name in 30-something years. Wow.
Well, we did a benefit for Ken because he was having health problems, and the benefit was here at the Broken Spoke. Well, I had this other friend named Johnny Lyon in the country New Notes.
Yeah.
That Johnny was a dear friend of mine. So Johnny says, won't you come down and play at the Spoke with us for this benefit? And I said, I'm in. I'll be there. Count on me. So we come down here, and Sammy is standing in the middle of the dance floor. And the band's playing. It's loud. And I go up to Sammy, and I said, I want to play Austin City Limits with you, yelling at him. And he yells back, okay.
Didn't have to audition or anything, huh?
Didn't have to. Well, Sammy had heard that I was with Leroy Parnell, which made everything smooth because Leroy, later on, we played for Sammy's wedding. And so that made things good.
Right.
You've got a friend. I know that friend. And if you're good with him, you're right. Good with me.
You know, and also, he'd have known that you had the chops
yeah.
to do the gig, too.
Yeah. You know? And so, you know, I was raised on Panther Hall in Cowtown Jamboree.
Sure.
You know, every Saturday, from the time I was about 11 till 14, 15, Saturday nights was in front of the TV watching Cowboy Weaver, Porter Wagner, all those shows that came on North Texas TV up there. And, Panther Hall and Cowtown Jamboree was the big ones. But we also had Buck Owens.
Right.
So that was my country education. And WBAP, Bill Mack.
And you also would have had the you'd have had the Big D Jamboree, too.
There, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The Sportatorium there.
Yeah, yeah. And the way it worked was every Saturday night they rotated those shows.
Right.
You know, you'd have Cowboy Weaver and the Sunset Ranch, and then you'd have Dolly and Porter and
when you say Buck Owens, let's be clear, we're not talking Hee Haw. We're talking about the actual show that he would tape in Bakersfield that I used to watch as a kid.
Well,
it was that, right?
At the time, I don't know if he was taping in Bakersfield or Oklahoma, Bob.
But it was yeah. It was not Hee Haw. It wasn't the comedy variety show.
This was way before Hee Haw. And going back and seeing those shows now, the camera shows a big ashtray with cigarettes going mm-hmm. in the middle of it and stuff, you know, and. But, man, you had Don Rich. And,
yeah.
Oh, he was so good. You had Tom Brumley. Willie was playing drums. Willie Cantu was playing drums. That whole band was just incredible. And so that was my education.
Right.
And every Saturday night, my dad, but now with my mother, it was a different thing. My mother listened to Janis Joplin. She listened to Jimi Hendrix and the blues and stuff. So I got two different sides of the coin. Rock and roll was on my and blues and stuff was from my mom, but my dad was diehard country.
Wow, that's
great,
great
education. Yeah.
Well, and it was for me, and of course all that ended as soon as I got my driver's license, because that got me out of town and I was on the road to Denton by then, but. That education paid off more and more. You know, I go back and lean on that more, especially for my country days. And meeting Sammy here, all that came into play. They'd go back and do the Leuven Brothers and all that stuff and the bicycle wreck. Now, I remember being as a young kid, when Sammy and Son was on Arthur Godfrey,
right,
and they would play the bicycle wreck, and as a young kid, I heard that. Didn't you know? Had no idea who they were, but right. I heard the song because back then, if you were a kid and heard any song about a bicycle, well, you were just
you're
mesmerized.
Stop, pay attention. Right,
absolutely.
Right.
But, you know, I got with Sammy, and we never looked back. That went on for 29, 30 years.
My goodness.
A great association. Yeah. You were with Sammy until his very end, until he passed.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and it was a great ride. It was the journey. I tell you, I wouldn't take anything for the journey now, you know, because it was just so good. He loved to play music, and he had this thing about, do we have fun? Is it a good place to play? Can we make a little money? You know, can we have a good time all the way around? And if it didn't meet those qualifications, he wouldn't take the job.
Right.
He said, it's okay to say no to some of these.
Right.
And that paid off in Aces. Mm-hmm. But, you know, all the Austin City Limits shows that we did, the Texas Connection, Louisiana Hayride.
All those Nashville Nows.
Yeah. I mean, oh, man, it was with Emory.
Of performances on Nashville Nows.
But the man had one of the biggest hearts.
Oh, right. Oh,
he would do anything in the world.
For anybody.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was the first person that ever told me that you can say no to a gig. And he said,
and you should.
He said, he said, if you turn down certain gigs, it will lead to bigger ones. He said, you watch. He was right. You know? Mm. He took me under his wing, under his arm. He told so many people in Nashville about me. He was the reason the Wagoneers ever got on Nashville Now. We must have done... Shit, I don't know, 30 episodes in Nashville Now, and he was the reason not only that we were on, but that Ralph Emery kept having us back.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, he was pretty tight with Ralph.
And he didn't have a dog in that fight. He didn't.
Great friends.
You know,
yeah.
He stood nothing to gain except we were you have to look at it contemporaneous to 1988, 89. The Wagoneers weren't like anything else, and Nashville was very wary and very scared of us. We were from Texas with this and... And hair and sideburns. I wrote our own songs, and Sammy got Ralph Emery to come on board and be a believer. And man, if you know, we for a while there we were doing Nashville Now like every 6 weeks. And mm-hmm.
That's great. Yeah.
You know, you're gonna the popularity of that TV show enabled you to be able to tour 250 dates a year. All over the country, and everywhere you went, say, from Nashville Now, the Wagoneers.
Well, there hasn't been a TV show like that at all, and I think that TV is
And also,
sort
you know, the cable, there were 20 cable channels. It's not like there were
700, but that show was special.
It was special. You know. And it was live. You had to be able to pick, and you had to be able to sing. There was no lip syncing.
Yeah, the Gieselslaws was the only act to be on Nashville Now every month.
Yeah, from the beginning till they packed it up, right?
And it just worked out that way. That's how much Ralph and Sammy believed in each other and what they were doing. I tell you, the anniversary show we did at Louisiana Hayride was incredible. We went back over there. I think it was the 50th year or something like that anniversary, and it was full house. But to be inside that auditorium and feel that, it's like the mother church for being over there. And, you know, there's a famous picture of Elvis on stage singing.
Behind it,
and Sammy's behind it wearing a derby-style hat. And while I was there, I kept seeing that image of that happen, you know. But,
and he loved Presley. Presley loved him. You know, I asked Sam one time, I said, well, did... You know, he told all the Elvis stories, and hey, Elvis, I like your suit. And Elvis said, "Man, I got two suits."
That's right.
Buddy Holly and Bob Montgomery here in town for a vocational convention, state vocational convention, and Sammy was fixing to open for Carl Perkins at Travis High School cafeteria, and got Buddy and Bob to open. So Buddy and Bob opened for the Gieselslaws. Opening for Carl Perkins at the
I never heard that story.
In
that
cafeteria.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
What did Sammy do? He got Buddy and Bob on this gig, you know, and what did he get them? $5, $10? It was more than they had. And he didn't know these guys, but he just found an opportunity to help another musician. And Sam Allred was always going to help a picker.
Oh, yeah.
Always. Yeah. Always.
You know. I mean, go ahead. I'm sorry.
The stories that Sammy told me, I tell you, they're just priceless. And you know, he told me about meeting Hank Williams Sr.
Yeah.
And it was down here at the auditorium. And Sammy and Son figured out early on that if you had a mandolin case or a guitar case, you could walk into anything and nobody would question you at the door. And so they went backstage and struck up a conversation with Hank Sr. And they were visiting, and Minnie Pearl was in the room. And Hank Sr. said, "Boys, why don't we step out here and let Miss Minnie get dressed?" And Sammy just thought that was wonderful, because he didn't say, "You boys have got to go and,
yeah, the three
and
shush
them out."
Out. Right.
They all three stepped out together. And, you know, that whole interaction and the jokes also that Miss Minnie would tell, you know, were just hilarious. She was just such a master storyteller. And, you know, with Elvis playing Desol Hall, Sammy and Son went out to see him, and they were back by the car, and Sammy said, "Well, Elvis, since you got your first hit record, I guess you'll be getting a bigger band." And he said, "No, I'm going to keep it just the way I got it." And Sammy said, "Elvi, won't you pick up the guitar and play me one?" He says, "Won't you pick up your mandolin and play me one?" So, you know, there was a little bit of that attitude, sure. You know, but, you know, they had that spark between them there, you know.
Sam told me one time, he said, Elvis was big enough, you know, he was doing well, still on Sun Records, but, you know, he was having hit records, you know.
Oh, yeah.
He said, and he said, "Elvis, why don't you get you a drummer?" Because it was just Elvis, Scotty, and Bill. And mm-hmm. and Elvis's acoustic guitar and Bill Black's slap bass was the only percussion. And he thought Elvis was going to say, "Would be so expensive, we'd have to, you know, pull a trailer, because once you have a drummer, you can't just all travel in one car, this, that, and the other." And he said, Elvis said, "Man, I'm afraid if I get a drummer," is what he said to Sam. He goes, "Afraid if I get a drummer, I'd start sounding like Bill Haley." He's like, "Elvis, I think if you got a drummer, you'd probably be just fine."
Oh,
so anyway,
boy.
And the funny thing is, like, DJ Fontana came on and played drums not just a couple, 3 months later, you know?
Yeah.
Wow.
But, you know, also, it's like country music had that thing about drums where, you know, maybe too loud, maybe they were a little bit of a black influence, you know, but here in Texas with our dance halls, and of course Bob Wills, because he had a Western swing band, he always had a drummer, always carried a drummer. But,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
The story is, mm-hmm. when Bob Wills showed up to play the Ryman for the Grand Ole Opry,
oh,
in the late 40s,
yeah.
He said, "We don't allow drums," and he turned around and went home.
Mm-hmm.
He
yeah.
never played the Opry.
Yeah.
People
yeah.
don't realize Bob Wills never played the Grand
never
Ole
made
Opry.
It.
Well, he wasn't going to, you know, he remembered that they, later on, they said, "Mr. Wills, you are more than welcome to come and bring your drummer." He said, "I'm all right."
I remember that.
Tales from the Broken Spoke is recorded live at the Broken Spoke in Austin, Texas, hosted by Country Radio Hall of Fame broadcaster Bob Pickett and Monty Warden. Recorded, mixed down, and produced by Mike Rivera.